Yugoslavian partisans led by Marshal Tito, who had become Yugoslavia's prime minister in March 1945, had come rushing toward Trieste as part of an attempt to regain some of the territory that had belonged to the Austrian-Hungarian Empire prior to the First World War. These communists had been thwarted by units of the U.S. 10th Mountain and 88th Infantry, Blue Devil Divisions, and by British forces as well, who moved up to occupy the contested region along a boundary called the Morgan Line. Trieste itself, a city that had been handed over to Italy by Austria in 1920 as a prize of war, was probably the greatest thorn in the Yugoslavs, or Jugs as we called them, side. And after a two-year standoff along the Morgan Line in 1947, the two nations signed a peace treaty that created the free territory of Trieste and divided it into zones. Two were occupied respectively by American and British troops, the third by Tito's boys, and the Jugs were less than pleased with the new arrangement. Tito felt that because Yugoslavia had fought on the right side during the war and Mussolini's Italy on the wrong, the Jugs deserved Trieste this time. Consequently, the post-war Allied troops, who'd been on a war footing in Italy from the word go, remained so. And although there were few full-on confrontations, while the Allies maintained a defensive posture in Trieste and along the Italian-Yugoslavian border, the communists nickeled and dimed us with small-scale guerrilla operations. The communists were the enemy. The Cold War was already in full swing. Winston Churchill had given his famous speech at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, predicting that an Iron Curtain would come slamming down over all of Eastern Europe. We on the ground could see the enemy with our own eyes, as day and night we watched them watch us from tall wooden towers along the border. What the enemy was about was brought home clearly at the Army's weekly troop information program, where films and lectures depicted the communists as monstrous, lumbering, savage, stupid beasts who would eat little kids if given half a chance. Know your enemy, we were told. We learned to know them, and we knew to hate them, which I thought was all pretty good since the day might come when I'd have to kill them. Still, the closest I ever came to chambering around in all 4 years I was in Italy was on 16 September 1947, Reunification Day, the day a Yugoslav regiment marched right down a road crossing the Jug-Trieste border, intent on passing through American and British lines to reach their zone of the newly divided city. The sole purpose of the Trust Command was to protect the American zone of Trieste proper. This incident involved, first and foremost, members of B Company 351st, a rifle company to which I'd briefly belonged and had only just left to join the 15th Tank Company in the first of my three trust assignments. After being told once that they could not pass through our lines, the Jugs withdrew, only to return to the same American outpost reinforced to the tune of 2,000 men. West Point Lieutenant William Van Dyke Oakes, Jr., my former platoon leader and at this time B Company's executive officer, XO, and acting CO, headed them off at the pass, firmly refusing to yield to the pressure of a Yugoslav colonel who threatened force if not allowed to proceed. The stakes were high as Oakes played out his bluff poker hand. His immediate force at the outpost was less than a dozen men. Meanwhile, everyone else in the 356 had gone on alert, thinking we were about to go to war. I was with the section of tanks that raced to the scene, but Lieutenant Oakes's initial cool had prevailed, and by the time we got there and took up battle positions, the incident was well on the way to blowing over, with higher military authorities on both sides conferring about a better way to solve the problem. Oakes himself became an instant hero, and the scuttlebutt concerning his act of calm but forceful battlefield diplomacy was one that stayed in my memory for a long, long time. My own experience in Company B had been short, basically because the minute I was assigned there, I raised hell until I could get out. I'm a recon man, I said again and again to anyone who would listen, and at 16, I'd just say it louder if they appeared to be ignoring me. I'm no dumb ground pounder. I was a real troublemaker, but the way I saw it was that the Army and I had a contract. I'd signed on not as an infantryman, but as a recon man, airborne recon, actually. I'd taken armored reconnaissance basic, and I'd loved my years zooming around in my little M24 light tank in the 752nd. You can't keep me here, I'd yell at my rifle platoon sergeant, even as he gave me the worst details and most painful close and sustained discipline an NCO could dish out. I think I was transferred only in order to shut me up, and even then I didn't get what I wanted. In fairness, that was only because what I wanted didn't exist. The closest thing to armored anything in trust was the 15th Tank Company, the oldest tank unit in the Army, predating even World War I, and that's where I was sent. My experience in the 752nd had taught me absolutely nothing about medium tanks, and the 15th's World War II Shermans, souped up with 76mm main guns, were huge steel monster mysteries to me. I learned quickly, of necessity, because I was assigned as assistant driver on a tank commanded by the meanest sergeant in the entire U.S. Army. Sergeant Dillard Oler of Harlan County, Kentucky, gave his gunner corrections in phrases like, down a crack, and left a cunt hair. He was the second best ass-kicker in the business. My platoon sergeant, Jesse O'Giddens, placed number one, and he kicked mine 24 hours a day until I loved and took care of his tank as though it were my first car. Sergeant Oler's 1947 expectations were actually those of 1930 regular Army soldierly perfection. The style of discipline required to meet this ideal took some getting used to, however, and until I got into the swing of things, I thought I was in prison. But it was the same throughout the tank company. I knew one trooper who'd spent time in the trust stockade, and when he came back, he said that as bad as the stockade was, and it was bad, in terms of unrelenting discipline, high standards, and tough soldiering, the 15th was even worse. Or better, depending on how you looked at it. Over the next 18 months with the tank company, I became a driver and a gunner corporal. And even then, if I'd missed a 55-gallon drum at 1,200 yards on the second shot, it would have been an immediate farewell to those two beautiful stripes. The rationale was simple. Mistakes on the training field will be mistakes on the battlefield, and mistakes on the battlefield lead to men's deaths. The tank NCOs, many of whom were pre-World War II horse cab regulars, were like gods. They were perfect and demanded the same from us instantly. They cut absolutely no slack as they worked overtime molding us into soldiers, in the process establishing standards that would remain with and in us for years to come. No detail escaped their eyes, and when, inevitably, one of us troops screwed up, we paid dearly for it. But the price was never as high as what we gained as a result. First, a respect and appreciation for details, the basic building blocks which, if neglected, can foul up the works completely. And second, an incredible boost to our morale when, wonder of wonders, we got it right. General of the Army George Catlett Marshall once said, "Morale is a state of mind. It is steadfastness and courage and hope, confidence and zeal and loyalty. Elan, esprit de corps and determination. Morale," he said, "is staying power, the spirit which endures to the end, the will to win." These words could have been the motto of the 15th Tank, and for that matter, all of Trust, a command that really did live 20 regular Army years behind the times. In truth, we were probably the last bastion of the old Army. An isolated unit on the Adriatic Sea, off by ourselves, we remained untainted by the problems that were already developing in the post-war army of a war-weary world. In Trust, however it may have been any place else, every day was a new challenge, and every day brought a new achievement. As a corporal, I was assigned on temporary duty, TDY, to the Regimental Training Unit, a provisional organization that trained new replacements right off the boat. Lieutenant Roland Carrier, commander of the Regimental Intelligence and Reconnaissance Platoon, was our provisional training officer. During the course of the program, he asked me if I'd come to his outfit as a squad leader. He said there'd be another stripe in it for me somewhere down the track. It was one of those offers I wouldn't have dreamed of refusing. I mean, I didn't even care that the I&R platoon was a ground pounder unit, and I beat feet over there as soon as I could. If Trust troops were proud, and they were, and if Trust troops were disciplined, and they most certainly were, then the I&R Trust troops were the proudest of the proud, the most disciplined of the disciplined. Our platoon sergeant, Steve Prezenka, was the ultimate taskmaster. He quickly became my mentor and my hero, the one I wanted to be like when I grew up and had a whole bunch of stripes of my own. Guided by his firm hand, the I&R platoon was an outstanding unit, without a doubt the best in the regiment. "If you learn it right, you'll do it right the rest of your life," Prezenka would growl as the endless repetition of one thing or another began to take its toll on his charges. "If you learn it wrong, you'll do it wrong, and you'll spend the rest of your life trying to learn to do it right." Thanks to him, we learned it right the first time around. We learned about weapons, ours and the enemy's, how to disassemble, assemble, and fire them. We spent days training in the woods, learning about camouflage, woodcraft, creeping, scouting, and observing. We became experts in what Prezenka called snooping and pooping, all under his watchful eye. We had an hour's close-order drill every day, using the drills of the 30s, and if Prezenka didn't like the way we did them, he'd turn back to the old field manual, which read, "Close-order drill is the foundation of all discipline," and throw another hour's worth on top of us. Holding a 9.5-pound M1 rifle at right shoulder arms isn't exactly a breeze at any time, and often, by the time the sergeant got through with us, our right hands would be locked stiff in the M1 grip position for hours, somehow not getting the word that the weapon wasn't there anymore. The importance of close-order drill could not be overestimated. The discipline it instilled was that which would maintain order on a chaotic battlefield. "You're in a life-or-death situation out there," Prezenka would say. "When you hear an order, you don't respond in 10 seconds or 10 minutes. You respond now, unless you want to get yourself or your buddy blown in half. And I don't want any Simon Says shit either. When I say move, move. When I say stop, stop. When I say knock out that machine gun, you knock out that machine gun. I don't want you to think about it. Just do it." Prezenka made out the training schedule. We marched to the tune he played, and loved him for it. He commanded our respect, effortlessly, it seemed. He was 22 years old, and to us, he'd been through it all. An I&R man from basic training onward, he'd been with the 28th Bloody Bucket Division I&R in World War II, and was captured, after a painful cat-and-mouse game with the Nazis deep behind the shattered U.S. lines during the Battle of the Bulge. He was just a total pro, the finest, fairest platoon sergeant who ever came down the track, who knew as much about soldiering as an Alabama Bible-bashing preacher knows about the good book. He could double-time 10 miles first thing in the morning regardless of what he'd drunk the night before. Sometimes he'd come roaring into our barracks at 0500, still loaded to the eyeballs from a wild night's partying, shouting, "Out of those sacks, boys! Let go of your cocks and grab your socks! It's time to go for a run!" And off we'd go. Usually it was just 5 or 6 miles, but on special occasions, if we bugged him enough, we'd run up to the town of Prosecco, about 9 miles round trip, to try to catch a glimpse of his girlfriend, Anna. The first time we'd gone up there, Anna had been out in a field tending her cows. She'd waved to us, all blonde hair and big tits, shouting, "Hello, Stevie!" And Prezenka never heard the end of it from his envious platoon. I&R, which was composed of the top scouts of the regiment, went out on foot and by vehicle to find the Reds. Our area of operation, AO, was a 200-mile stretch fronting the Jug border. I learned plenty during these long patrols, sneaking around in the woods, but the most alarming lesson was that I had no sense of direction. In recon, having no sense of direction is kind of like being a surgeon who can't stand the sight of blood. From my experience in D Company 752nd, the fact was I knew every inch of the AO by memory. Someone could give me coordinates, and just by looking at a particular curve on a road or a prominent feature in the terrain, I could get within a few hundred meters of any given destination without once referring to a map. But put me on the ground within that terrain of dense bush and millions of trees, and I was hopeless. I had no navigational sense whatsoever. I would have blamed Prezenka, except that he drilled us in map reading all the time. "Finding the enemy isn't worth a damn," he'd say, "if you can't give HQ an exact fix on their location." And he was a natural at it himself. So I made a private vow. If ever I attained any rank at all, I'd always find a subordinate who was a great map reader and make him my direction man. In the I&R, this job was eventually assigned to a New Jersey-born Daniel Boone Sylvester Wilson, a private in my squad. That way I could concentrate on the ground and the immediate situation. I wouldn't have to get all wrapped around the axle in all the details and mysteries of ground navigation and reading right up. And most important, no one would ever know that I rarely even knew where I was. But attaining rank was not easy in Trieste. Promotions were not automatic issue. You soldiered for them, and you soldiered hard. The slightest infraction could lead to a bust. Your platoon sergeant could and would pull the stripes right off your sleeve. I'd actually learned my lesson back at Fort Knox during basic when my training sergeant mistook my well-made bed and perfectly shined shoes as signs of previous military training. I hadn't been about to tell him I'd learned it hanging around the Army base near my house in Ocean Park, and appointed me Lance Sergeant, complete with 3 regular Army stripes, which were sewn on a black band to be pinned to my shirt sleeves like an MP's brassard. I took my acting jack job most seriously, and was thought to be a shoe-in for the best trainee, an honor that included a promotion to PFC on completion of the course, until a week before basic was over, and I had my squad out on a training recon patrol. In my 15-year-old judgment, the exercise we were on had no value. The other kids agreed, so I decided it was too nice a day to beat around in the bush and told everyone to take it easy. We found a pond and had a good swim. Of course, we got caught by the platoon sergeant, and not only was it goodbye little black band and 3 regular Army stripes, but it was hello KP, Private Hackworth, for the rest of the time I was there. It took me 18 months in Italy to regain that lost ground, despite the fact that as early as my stint in the 752nd, I'd gone to the toughest NCO preparatory school in the world, the 88th Division Leadership School near Venice, on the island of Lido. This school was yet another torture chamber of old Army exacting discipline. Chief Instructor Lieutenant Radar Ryan, so-called because he had eyes in the back of his head and he saw everything, had little tolerance for the less than perfect. If you had a quarter-inch thread dangling on your fatigue jacket, he called it a rope, burned it off with his Zippo lighter, and sentenced you to scrape out the inside of a toilet with a razor blade at midnight. If you succumbed to a blink while standing at attention, you could safely look forward to a 4-hour nightly duty of scrubbing the barracks walls with a toothbrush. These activities were, of course, extracurricular. Besides instilling perfection, the daily function of the school was to teach us to set the example, and through various leadership challenges, burn into our brains the 11 principles of leadership in action. When the course was finished, I was chomping at the bit to have a crack at the real task. Little did I know that when I was finally promoted to PFC, I'd stay right there for a whole year more. Nobody wants to be a private, but being a PFC isn't much better. Anyone worth his salt wants to be at least a corporal, because then he has power. He can give orders, not just have to take them. And he doesn't have to pull guard nearly as much as the privates and PFCs. Long before the leadership school, when I was about 10, I'd watched all those old sergeants stationed in Ocean Park barking at their troops. When years later I finally made corporal in the tank company, I called on those memories in order to become the meanest bastard of an NCO the world had ever seen. Newly, proudly perched on the first rung of the leadership ladder, it'd be fair to say I was much hated by my squad, but I didn't care. From my earliest memory, my sights had been set on a buck sergeant's stripes, like my great uncle Roy had worn in World War I, and I'd learned enough in the Army already to know you didn't get them from being Gordon Goodguy. I really went to town when I got my own squad in the I&R. I'd been a fanatical field manual reader and memorizer since I joined the Army. Now that I was in charge, I was determined that my squad would be as well-versed as I was. I'd assign them reading with the warning that any time within the next hour, day, or week, I'd come back to them and make them tell me what that manual said. Prezenka told me later he'd have a private laugh every time I assigned this homework. He'd never gone with that theory of book learning. He believed in doing, but didn't see anything wrong with it. If nothing else, it put the fear of God in my squad, which was good. I just wanted my guys to be the best at everything. The duty day began before reveille and ended only when I was satisfied that my squad was spit and polished perfection. It was not unusual for me to have them scrubbing the barracks walls, washing windows, and laying out their equipment for my own personal full field inspection, which I'd carry out just before taps. The guys' gear would glisten in the dull barracks light. Chrome-plated bayonet and mess gear, lacquered tent poles and pegs, the M1's butt plate chromed, its rifle stock bonded and French waxed, the helmet liner painted, baked, and simonized to a blinding finish. Anything brass was stripped of paint and polished. The rivets on helmet liners, the eyelets and buckles on boots, the snaps on cartridge belts, even the rough leather exterior of our World War II combat boots would shine like patent leather after being smoothed over with a dog tag chain and waxed and polished until a soldier could see his face. I didn't make up these rules of cosmetic precision. They were just part of the basic trust standard, itself undoubtedly influenced by the discipline of the stockade, the large number of old Army NCOs in our command, and the spit-and-polish elite British troops who co-located with us. I wasn't above them, either. After all, my shoelaces, too, had to be washed and pressed before Prezenka made his full field inspection. But continuing the tank company's NCO tradition of cutting no slack was, to my mind, close to a guarantee that my squad would stand head and shoulders above all others. Still, I quietly thanked the designer of our wall lockers, who'd provided false bottoms where we could stash the field gear we really used and hid away before inspection. However hellish my nocturnal reviews seemed to the men of my squad, though, they were nothing compared to my wrath if the guys didn't measure up. All things considered, I was actually quite civilized on these occasions. Generally, I'd just decide that no one was going to go on pass. "Gentlemen," I'd say, "I want you to fall out in the company street." I would then double-time them to the front gate, halt them, and have them stand at parade rest. Then I'd say, "Now, gentlemen, there is the front gate. That front gate is designed for soldiers who are good soldiers, soldiers who deserve a pass. A pass is a privilege, not a right you have that you get automatically. You get a pass for making me happy, for having beautiful shoes and beautiful weapons and being motivated and spirited and dedicated. I have found you to be failing in all of these areas. So you are not going to pass through that gate. You are not going out until I consider you fit to go out, until you are soldiers who are fit to walk in the streets of Trieste. I am not proud of you, man, and the reason you're not going out is because I am not proud of you." Then I'd double-time them back to the barracks and open my locker where they'd see all their passes thumb-tacked under the lid. "There are your passes," I'd say. "There they are, and that's where they are going to stay until I'm impressed with you. Now that may be months, gentlemen. I just don't know how long that's going to be." First Sergeant English, the top kick of headquarters company to which the I&R platoon belonged, made sure that my enthusiasm didn't keep my men off the streets of Trieste forever, but meanwhile, I got and held their attention, and they shaped up. The guys in my I&R squad liked me just about as much as my tank crew had when I'd first made corporal. Still, day by day, our little band began to work together better and better until we were bopping along like a well-oiled machine. To me, the proof came on the training field, on a regimental training exercise for which the I&R was designated the aggressor force. My squad was given the mission of infiltrating behind 1st Battalion lines and capturing a prisoner, preferably an officer. I decided that if we had to get an officer, we might as well get the commanding officer, so we set our sights on the helmet, Lieutenant Colonel James Muir II, CO of the 1st Battalion. We called Muir the helmet because he was very small, and when he put on his steel pot, it seemed to come down to the top of his boots. Capturing him would be a real coup. He was a well-liked, damn good officer who got around, saw his troops, and cared a lot about their welfare. and there seemed little doubt his men would go to any lengths to protect him. Since I knew our AO like the back of my hand, I concluded that Colonel Muir would set up his command post, CP, in one of only two places, in a hollow behind the Red Cross Club or in an orchard by Opichina. Our recon confirmed it was the Red Cross Club. We slipped behind it using side trails and camouflaged our three recon jeeps on the side of a road nearby. In the darkness and on foot, we got to a place where we were looking down on the enemy. Colonel Muir's CP was hidden in a clump of trees. The sun was just rising. We could pick out tents and vehicles and hear the sound of generators. The colonel had a rifle company close in for security. As the I&R were the aggressors, we were wearing dark green Russian-looking uniforms with a red triangular patch, as well as special helmets with a wooden block on top. It was winter, bitter cold, so we were also wearing heavy parkas with hoods. I instructed my men to wear their hoods over their helmets. That way, when we got into the CP area, 1st Battalion wouldn't be able to tell us from their own. It was getting light as we infiltrated through the CP. People were getting up. I could hear mess kits clattering and guys moving through a chow line. Even though it was only a maneuver and no one could get hurt, I still had that scared feeling in the pit of my stomach, that prayer that we wouldn't get caught. My fear was wholly unjustified, though, because after we got into the CP, as far as the enemy could see, we were indeed just some of their guys strolling through the area with our hoods on. We made our way to Colonel Muir's tent and disarmed and captured the guard outside. Then I went into the tent. The colonel was sleeping. I gently shook him awake.
"Yes, what is it?" he asked.
"Colonel Muir, I'm Corporal Hackworth from Regimental I&R, and you're a prisoner of war." Muir's eyes popped open, and he reached under his pillow. He was an old soldier, and I knew he had a pistol there. I had my weapon pointed at him.
"Sir, I have the drop on you. I hope you'll play the game. If you'll just put on your gear and come with us."
Muir withdrew his hand from under the pillow.
"Fair enough, Hackworth. I'll play the game."
He could have taken his time. He could have made some noise. He could have pulled rank. But he didn't. He played the game. We left his tent and walked down the road until we got to our jeeps. I put him in the back with two guys, then hopped in the front with the driver. The windshield was down, with canvas to prevent glare tied over it on the hood as we drove through Muir's positions. No one suspected us. After all, we were driving out of First Bat lines, and besides, the colonel himself was sitting calmly in the back seat. It was a perfect operation. The main road from Muir's battalion to our regimental CP was mined with dummy anti-tank mines. They weren't dug in, just sitting on top of the road as window dressing for the exercise. But as we swerved around them, about 3 miles out of Muir CP, elements of the 1st Battalion recognized our I&R vehicles and started shooting at us with blanks. We zoomed on as fast as we could, but the windshield on my Jeep hadn't been tied down properly and suddenly it flew up, the canvas cover obstructing the driver's vision. "No operation ever goes according to plan," went the old military axiom. And in my mind's eye, I saw the Jeep crashing into a tree, killing everyone, including the colonel, which would have been a bit hard to explain if I'd been unlucky enough to survive. I threw myself onto the windshield and stayed there until we were beyond enemy range. Then we stopped the Jeep, blindfolded Colonel Muir, turned him around 9 times, by the book so he wouldn't be able to find our CP when he was released, and drove on to a dismount point near our headquarters. I reported in to our regimental commander, Colonel Paul W. Carraway, at his CP. Captain Kenneth Eggleston, the HQ Company CO, was there, too, and both were almost as excited as I was about the capture of Colonel Muir, whom I considered my own personal trophy. The I&R got kudos and letters of commendation from Carraway on down for our work on that maneuver. My own reward was getting my ass chewed by someone at the CP because, in all the excitement, I'd taken off my much-hated aggressor helmet and left it in the Jeep outside. But that was trust for you, and I was so proud of myself and my squad that it didn't hurt much at all. And after this maneuver, Colonel Muir never forgot me. Every time he saw me, he'd say, "I'll get your ass, Hackworth." But good soldier that he was,
He always said it with a smile.
"I'd like to tell you something, Dave," Captain Eggleston began a few weeks before he promoted me to sergeant. "I feel that one day you will achieve a very high rank, and you are going to make a significant contribution to your country." This was a captain talking to a corporal, and I was dumbstruck. I liked Captain Eggleston, tall and lean with an incredible combat record from his days with the 10th Mountain Division in World War II. He was tough as they come, but he had a heart as big. He was a real leader who was never without a word of encouragement for the troops, and over the months he'd become kind of a father figure to me. Even so, his comments now, to my mind, came from out of the blue. Once a month or so, I'd catch a duty called Charge of Quarters. It was a rostered duty, and the CQ's job was basically to play high sheriff for the night, from the time the HQ company commander went home until he or the top kick returned in the morning. There really wasn't much to do but keep things squared away and ride herd on pass control, bed check, and any unusual events, fights, arrests, breakdowns of equipment, and so forth, that occurred during the night. I was just coming off CQ when the captain sat me down and dropped this prophetic bomb. All I could do was mumble a thank you and get out of there to give myself a chance to think. Personally, I didn't expect to achieve a very high rank, and I didn't know what Captain E even meant by the significant contribution I'd make to my country. Even so, his words couldn't have come at a more opportune time. It was the eve of the end of my first hitch, and I had to decide whether to re-enlist or go home. I'd been giving the matter a lot of thought recently. I was 18 years old, and it was time to start figuring out what I was going to do with the rest of my life anyway, and the conclusion I'd kept coming to was that, in almost all ways, the Army was my home, that I loved it, that I belonged here. Maybe I'd already decided to make the Army my career, but I'm sure Captain Eggleston's belief in me provided the final nudge. As for the captain's predictions, though, well, only time would tell. Then Sergeant Prezenka went back to the States on reenlistment leave and was gone for a number of months. In his absence, his replacement, Sergeant Charlie Durham, rotated home, having finished his tour, and I found myself as acting platoon sergeant, responsible for the training of the I&R. I took on my new role with great confidence and full enthusiasm, and managed to alienate most of the platoon within days. The older soldiers of the outfit, the combat vets of World War II, resented me most of all. I was playing out the role of Prezenka, and pretty well, I hoped, but with no experience to back me up. Other than a few brushes with red guerrillas along the border, I'd never heard a shot fired in anger, and all I really knew about war was what I'd seen in the movies and read about in manuals and books. The guys had long been calling me Combat. Now it became Sergeant Combat. "Ask Sergeant Combat. He'll tell us how to do it," they'd say, to which I'd reply, "You're goddamned right. Field Manual 7-75, Paragraph 101 says you'll do it this way, and that's the way I want to see you doing it right now." I was determined not to let them get to me, but it was hard. I'd been in the Army now for more than 3 years, yet when it was all shaken out, I was still a greenhorn. Prezenka came back from leave then, and I went back to my squad. I had no regrets about my decision to re-up, but I was antsy. The guys in the platoon still called me Sergeant Combat, and it frustrated the hell out of me because, after all, it wasn't my fault there wasn't a war going on. But out of the blue, all that changed when, on 25 June 1950, North Korea crossed the border into the South. U.S. troops around the world went on full alert. We moved to our battle positions because the word was that the communists weren't going to stop at South Korea. They were going to bust out all over the globe. We were ready for them at Trieste. The regiment moved to the border to await the marching Red Army. Day followed day, and they never came. My adrenaline was running fast, and I wanted to be where the action was. I couldn't stop talking about it. Every day I'd warn Prezenka to treat me nice. I was going to Korea, and I might just give him all my medals when I came back. I was ready to try out my warrior wings. I wanted to prove myself. I wanted to win that combat infantryman's badge, CIB.
I just wanted to go. So badly it hurt. During the alert, in that the I&R manned the critical regimental observation posts, OPs, we were frequently visited by regimental commander Colonel Carraway. The colonel was a stern, no-nonsense, often seemingly unapproachable man, but on one of his visits I got up enough nerve to ask him to help me get over to Korea. He said he'd see what he could do, and within a few weeks I got my orders. Colonel Carraway had even arranged it so that I was to be flown back to the States, unheard of at a time when most all troop transport out of trust was by ship. I said goodbye to my buddies and hopped on the plane, the first NCO from Trieste on the way to Korea. Many more soon followed, of course, and about 75% of the trust NCOs who went and lived were destined to be either battlefield commissioned to lieutenant or to receive high awards, proving that the chrome-plated soldiers of Europe, of trust, trained in the spirit and with the dedication of what was probably an anachronism of an army, were indeed soldiers of the highest caliber. But in September 1950, on that plane from Italy to the States, I didn't really know that, nor did I know, in general, how much I didn't know, especially in matters of life and death. But I did know that I was hot to trot and ready for whatever came my way, and that if nothing else, I wasn't going to be Sergeant Combat ever again. A month later, I was in Korea. And a month after that, so were the Chinese.
3. Hit and run. The thing that bothered me worse than anything that winter was the cold. I'd always gone through my life bitching about it being too hot or too cold. During the pullback from the Yalu, I decided I would never complain about the heat again if I could only just get warm. And the thing you had to realize, with life expectancy what it was on the battlefield, was that chances were you weren't going to live until spring anyway. You had to realize that you might never get warm again. Colonel Allen D. Bell, Jr., U.S. Army, retired. G Company, 27th Artillery Forward Observer, Korea, 1950 through 51. The course of the Korean War had changed dramatically since its lightning-fast beginning. At the start, U.S. forces, hopelessly outnumbered, outgunned, and undertrained, had been driven back by the North Koreans into the tiniest corner of South Korea, beyond the Nakdong River. There, the 8th Army dug in its heels, determinedly holding what was known as the Pusan Perimeter until September, when MacArthur's daring amphibious invasion at Incheon severed the North Korean Army's lines of communications and chopped its legs out from under it. No longer was the enemy an effective fighting force, and our certain defeat along the lines of Dunkirk in 1940 suddenly appeared to be surefire victory. Units of the 8th Army smashed out of the Nakdong Perimeter. Spirits were high as we raced north beyond the 38th parallel, beyond the North Korean capital of Pyongyang, to within spitting distance of the Yalu River, the dividing line between North Korea and Manchuria. Fighting was sporadic, but as units moved farther north, the weather worsened and enemy resistance increased. It was like compressing a spring. The night the Chinese came, I was in a foxhole in the center of my scout section's defensive position. The sector was densely covered with screw pines and scrub oaks. My foxhole buddy and I were sitting on the edges of our hole when we saw, and it was like right out of a cartoon, a row of the small trees moving toward us. We chopped them down, along with the little Chinaman creeping along behind each one with hand grenades, but that was just the beginning. The next thing I saw was what I could only describe as a wave, a human wave, of Chinese crashing over us. For the next 3 hours they came, wall-to-wall Chinamen, many of whom did not even have rifles, only long lances tipped with bayonets. Others were armed with U.S. Thompson submachine guns or Russian drum-fed assault rifles. For the main, they were sorry shots with no understanding of basic infantry tactics, but what the Chinese lacked in proficiency, they made up for in numbers, and their presence heralded the start of the largest and most bitter retreat in U.S. Army history. Upon my arrival in Korea, I'd been assigned to the 25th Recon Company as a replacement scout section leader. It was an Army mistake. My military occupational specialty, MOS, was infantry, not armored recon.
and it had upset me no end because 25th Recon guys were not eligible for the CIB regardless of how much infantry combat they saw. Add to that MacArthur's brilliant stroke at Incheon, the war had seemed over save for the victory parade, and I'd been sick that after all I'd gone through to get here, I'd missed the guts of the whole damn show. I hadn't wanted to end up in another occupation force, still Sergeant Combat, only in a new theater. In my heart, I'd secretly wished the war would continue long enough to let me get involved in at least one good fight. My wish came true, only too well. My first real firefight had occurred just before the Chinese came on a dull, overcast day. The scout section had set up near a secondary road. We spotted a squad of North Korean soldiers, weapons at sling arms, coming out of the tree line. They were good-looking troops, but asleep at the switch. They didn't see us. It was amazing the sense of power I'd felt. Ultimate power, I suppose, just watching them come and holding that weapon in my hands. We let them get within about 30 yards before we cut loose. I dropped four guys point blank with my M1, each dead with a 6 o'clock sight picture in the chest, just like the good book said. I felt no guilt. Few of us did. I'd been trained too well. And besides, the enemy had been utterly dehumanized throughout my training. They aren't men. They're just gooks, I thought, as the four enemy fell and a fierce firefight began. We'd knocked off the point element of a much larger enemy force and stirred up a hornet's nest. The term gook is derived from the Korean word hangook, which means Korean person. Following the lead of a lot of the older veterans, earlier in the day I'd placed several clips of ammo in my rifle sling. I liked the look. It was kind of John Wayne-ish, and it seemed to make sense, a new clip only seconds away. But when I'd taken up my prone firing position, the sling had flopped on the rain-soaked ground. Now, as the firefight got going, I grabbed for a clip only to discover that it and the rest of them were clogged with mud. Bullets were flying and my brain stalled out. I vaguely remembered an old tale about how well the M1 worked under any battlefield condition. Quickly knocking off the bigger pieces of mud, I oozed the clip into my rifle. I got one round off. The weapon jammed, and for the next few minutes I sat in the ditch, field stripping, cleaning, and reassembling the thing, while my first real combat went on without me. Our artillery, arty fire, took the starch out of the North Korean advance, and we were able to scoot ass with no friendly casualties, other, that is, than Sergeant Combat's bruised pride. My first fight had been my first screw-up. I didn't know until much later that you generally don't walk away from that one. A few days later, five of us had been on a reconnaissance patrol. It was a black night, save for the U.S. flares that hung eerily over the battlefield. Very quiet, but for the occasional whine of artillery fire and the odd burst of an automatic weapon. We had moved about a mile into enemy territory when we heard motors. Leaving the patrol, I crawled to a mound near the edge of the road for a first-hand look. Through the darkness, silhouetted by the artillery flares, I could see four enemy vehicles. A file of infantry was walking on each side of the motor column, with more infantry walking in front. They were so close that I was sure only the vehicle's engines prevented them from hearing my pounding heart. They passed by. I was about to return to the patrol when I saw a lone North Korean soldier, his weapon slung, tracing a telephone wire. As he passed my position, I parted his hair with the submachine gun magazine and dragged him back to the patrol. Daylight wasn't far off when we headed home. Progress was slow. Initially, we had to pack our zonked-out prize. Later, he awoke and stumbled along belligerently, but at least under his own steam. Just when we thought we had made it, we ran into a large enemy force moving down the road in formation. They were jabbering excitedly and dragging machine guns behind them on squeaky wheels. We were about 6 yards from the road. I lay on top of the prisoner, covered his mouth with my hand, and pressed my trench knife hard against his throat. I thought the cold steel would be enough to convince him to be good, but it wasn't. Old habits die hard. He started squirming around. My hand was muffling his cries to his comrades. When he tried to bite it, I had no choice. I slit his throat and lay there on top of him for what seemed like a bloody eternity, until the road was clear and we could hotfoot it back to the U.S. lines. I hadn't wanted to kill him. I would rather have captured the guy. A live prisoner is worth 1,000 dead hombres. But I was probably as scared as he was, and in a millionth of a second, I'd had to decide, and it was either him or my patrol. Killing that guy and one other incident probably hammered home most that Korea was not some training maneuver, that I was really in a war, boots and all. The other occurred when we were digging in on a small knob overlooking a main north-south road. Digging in was a task a frontline trooper performed at least once a day when on the move. Usually, you spent the time cursing your commander for always choosing the hardest ground in town, and then moving the line just when you finished your hole. Some of us thought it was an army plot to keep us in shape. For myself, I'd rather have done a million push-ups. But on this particular occasion, we'd gotten some great dirt. It was soft and loose, a breeze to dig in, and I was about 2 feet down in no time. Then my shovel hit something mushy. A few quick scrapes revealed olive drab, OD green material. A few more uncovered the decaying corpse of a man with bright red hair and a 24th Division patch on his moldy fatigue jacket. The soldier's hands had been tied behind him with communication commo wire, and he'd been shot in the back of the head. Three more bodies were found by other troopers on our little knob, all killed and buried the same way. Company was notified. They said the men probably had been killed at the beginning of the war. That was when the 24th Division, the 25th's sister division from the pre-World War II Hawaii days, had fought along this road. We were instructed to dig out the dog tags and provide 8-digit coordinates where each body was found. The atrocity did little for morale, but a lot for fighting spirit. There would be little love lost for an enemy as savage as the North Korean Reds. So much for the Korean police action, I and my friends all thought. This was all-out war, with no quarter given. Now that the Chinese were in the conflict, the recon company's mission was to provide a reconnaissance screen in front of the 25th Infantry Division's withdrawal. In other words, to delay, deceive, and disorganize the undeniable communist advance. The Chinese had struck 8th Army like a giant steamroller, crushing many units and mauling most others. 8th Army's commander, Lieutenant General Walton Walker, who had said in July of 1950, as the first real southward began, "There will be no Dunkirk. There will be no Bataan. A retreat to Pusan would be one of the greatest butcheries in history. We must fight until the end," now found himself directing yet another brave but bloody withdrawal to the south. Only 7 years before, General Eisenhower's forces were similarly surprised and smashed, but that time we'd had Patton to save the day. In my heart of hearts, I kind of wished someone would get the idea to use our recon company as the spearhead to bastone for the Korean conflict. But it was not to be, and it was just as well. Unlike the 752nd Recon, which had had 17 M24 light tanks, we were a light-skinned force with only 6 M24s in the whole company. Divide these up among 3 identical platoons. Each platoon was composed of 2 M24 tanks, a rifle squad, a scout section, and an 81mm mortar squad, which were normally attached, one to each regiment, and it wasn't exactly the punch Lieutenant Colonel Creighton Abrams had had in 1944. Still, we had plenty to do to keep us occupied. Exchanging ground for time, the drill went that we would hold a position until the enemy was breathing hot and heavy down our necks. Then we would break contact and run like hell, leapfrogging through another recon platoon or a rifle unit that was set up behind us in the same way. It was a dangerous game with no room for error, and we found ourselves playing it day after day after day. They were strange dudes, the Chinese, seemingly with no sense of personal peril. It was not unusual to see them jump on a U.S. tank, holding grenades, and then scramble around looking for some opening to toss them in. Of course, if the tank was buttoned up, this was impossible, and the tank commander inside would simply call another tank nearby to scratch my back, at which point the second tank would spray the first with 30-caliber coaxial machine gun fire and wash the hitchhikers off. But there were always other Chinamen to take the dead ones' places. It was a grim fact we were constantly reminded of as we kept moving south. Morale dropped with every rearward step of the humiliating retreat. We kept falling back, away from the Yalu, beyond Pyongyang, until soon we'd recrossed the 38th parallel and were back in South Korea. The only things I think running faster than the 8th Army were the rumors. The Marines were cut off at a place called Chosin River in the north and were being zeroed out. The U.S. Army's 10th Corps had surrendered. Boats were waiting at Pusan Harbor to take us to Japan. Meanwhile, winter had arrived, but winter gear had not. MacArthur had said we'd be home before Christmas. I guess his supply people believed him, because the Chinese had caught us with our pants down, and they were summer trousers. Feet in leather boots froze. Gloves and mittens were as scarce as good-looking girls. Our field jackets were as thin and protective as page one of a newspaper. We were slowly freezing to death in the bitter below-zero weather while the Chinese, like Genghis Khan's mighty hordes, marched on, seemingly unstoppable. Food was in short supply. All spare time was spent scrounging. One of the most modern armies in the world became an army of days past, foraging and living off the land. We kicked in walls of houses, searching for rice and kimchi. Fermented cabbage, a Korean staple, hidden in false walls and secret caches. We cooked what we found in our steel pots. When nothing else was available, we'd take the sea ration packets of sugar, powdered coffee, powdered milk, and chocolate we'd stored for days like squirrels in the pockets of our fatigues, mash it all together with snow in our helmets, and trick ourselves into believing it was ice cream. Trying to beat the elements became a war in itself. It was so bitterly cold you couldn't sleep. You had to keep moving, stomping feet and flexing fingers 24 hours a day. Those who didn't were saying goodbye to their hands and feet, and in some cases their lives. For a while, every day a couple of men were evacuated because of frostbite, black toes and fingers to be cut off at the hospital. Grenades, knives, and ammo would freeze fast to the foxhole brim. Weapons froze too. You'd have to kick the bolts of the M1s and Browning automatic rifles, BARs, to get them back. We seldom had rifle patches to clean our weapons. Most of us cut little squares out of our shirts or trousers to do the best we could. Gun oil was a luxury usually beyond our reach. We lubricated our weapons with motor oil or the frozen lard of sea rations and took to keeping them with us in our fart sacks at night. Staying alive became our only concern. And we did. Man is most adaptable. When we passed through the villages, if a house had lots of wood, doors, window frames, even the most beautiful hand-carved furniture, we'd burn it, one piece at a time, finishing off the job by throwing a thermite grenade on the thatch roof and standing by until the whole structure was burned to the ground. Our orders were to destroy anything the enemy could use. Gladly, we thought to ourselves, and we could stay warm while we did it. At night, we would carefully, obsessively bundle, stack, and restack kindling wood while waiting for daybreak when we could light our fires. The thought of those friendly flames allowed us to make it through the night. Instantaneously, at first light, thousands of tiny fires would spring up across the front, and around each huddled a cluster of shivering men. It was probably as bad in the Chinese camp. Except at least the Chinks were prepared with winter gear, down trousers and jackets, long overcoats that blended in with the snow, and down mittens that we liberated and wore until our own supply people came through. It was a frigid, brutal, soul-destroying time. I knew then how the Wehrmacht must have felt during World War II, or how Napoleon's army must have suffered years and years before that, when each made their horrible winter retreat from Russia. By the time we reached Seoul, the South Korean capital, once a bustling city of millions, was virtually deserted, an empty gray tomb. Most of its inhabitants and those of the northern villages on its outskirts had left and headed south with the few possessions they could carry, clogging the roads with wall-to-wall human misery. On one occasion, American fighter planes must have concluded that the hordes of desperate civilians were Chinese columns moving south. P-51s had strafed the refugees, and for at least a mile there were dead littered across the road. Retreating vehicles had to push the bodies out of the way. It was here that I realized it was only the guys on the ground who saw and understood the real horrors of war. To Air Force pilots, war is a remote thing. They make their kills from hundreds or thousands of feet in the air. Even the guys who fly on the deck do so in a flash, dropping their loads and flying away without seeing the results, the way homes and people are blown to smithereens, or the effects of napalm. At night, they didn't have to listen, as we did in the winter of 1950, to the wail of the gooks, cries of civilian refugees begging to be let through American lines, or see in the morning, when they were allowed to pass through, the dead they'd left behind, those who'd frozen to death in open rice paddies overnight. The pilot, when he finishes his day's work, flies back to his base, lands, goes to the club, has a big steak, and if he wants to forget the day's combat, he can drink himself into a stupor. The frontline fighter can't do that. He lives with death and the horror of the battlefield every day and every night. It's his cross to bear. We continued retreating. Gray, rotting bodies, the unforgettable smell of death, rats feasting on the dead and growing bolder by the day. This, the flotsam and jetsam of war, led us through Seoul. Our unit's mission was to fight a rear-guard action in the center of the city. The scout section and rifle squad set up at a downtown intersection. We took over a bank, a drugstore, and two other corner buildings. For my command post, I used the bank manager's plush office. Moving uptown, I thought, which was a welcome diversion from the cold and snow. The bank vault was locked tight. As the self-appointed new bank manager, I authorized the guys to open it with their 3.5 anti-tank bazooka. Two rounds later, the door swung open as easily as a sea ration can in the hands of a hungry trooper. The vault contained thousands of dollars in small Korean notes. All the big stuff was gone. I told everyone to cash in. No withdrawal forms needed, I said, and they did. We had to laugh at the propaganda leaflets that the Chinese mortared down upon us from the hills they occupied on the high ground around Seoul. American capitalists, running dogs of Wall Street, they accused. How right they are, I thought, as we stuffed pockets and packs and even made hobo sacks to carry our spoils of war. It was strange watching the Chinese brazenly looking down from those hills about 600 or 800 yards away. Our infantry weapons were out of range, preventing a little selective sniping, but we were able to put some effective fire on them with the M-24's main gun and had great fun taking pot shots with the turret's 50 caliber. The Chinese went to ground, and shy of a cheerless Christmas, we slipped out of sad, near-deserted Seoul. My section's newfound wealth was the first thing to be tossed on the side of the road. Bulky dollars meant little to worn-out troopers, and it had just been a game anyway. South of Seoul, we found ourselves caught in a friendly battle zone, a railway yard being blasted to kingdom come by demolition-toting engineers and Air Force bombers, railroad flat cars complete with brand-new vehicles and tanks, which would have been distributed to the front had it not collapsed, were being blown sky-high to keep them out of enemy hands. To us in the middle, the challenge of this army obstacle course was not only to avoid our own flying debris, but also the enemy incoming, which was pouring in throughout the operation. We came upon a number of freight cars with sealed doors. One of the guys pried one open to reveal an entire carload of PX supplies, soap, cigarettes, aftershave lotion, obviously goodies needed by our rear echelon comrades. I mean, they seldom found their way to the front, and we decided to help ourselves. Someone drove a brand new 3/4-ton truck off a nearby flat car, so we had a way to carry out the loot. It fell about 4 feet and crashed to the ground, springs breaking, fenders collapsing, but it still ran. We loaded our spoils onto the truck even as telephone poles, uprooted by our explosives and large chunks of steel, rained down around us. Then we jumped aboard ourselves and unasked the place. 8 recon men bouncing along in a truck right out of the grapes of wrath. We motored by a battalion of infantry hiking south down the road. "Hey, how you fixed for cigarettes?" we called. "And Aquavelva, anyone?" as we threw all the troopers a little something. We ran out of goodies about the same time our mobile PX ran out of gas, and we reluctantly returned to the backs of our tanks with the rest of our platoon. We were young. Sometimes the war was great fun, like a game of cops and robbers, or cowboys and Indians, that you played as kids. The politics or purpose of the war was not our concern. We didn't understand or care about the big picture any more than we really understood the risks of combat, of being killed, or going home without a leg. After a while, you stopped worrying if the next minute you were going to get it. Instead, you just prayed for a clean wound to get you out of there, a million-dollar wound to get you home. After we retreated across the Han River, my platoon was given the mission to outpost a long, lonely stretch of the South Bank. It was Christmas Day, and although no Chinese were in sight, it wasn't a particularly jolly time. General Walker had been killed 2 days before in a freak Jeep truck accident very similar to the one that had killed his World War II boss, General Patton. Still, paratroop General Matt Ridgway had taken over as the new commander of 8th Army, and the word was we would retreat no farther. It was a good word, but my platoon had a more immediate concern. We were starving. A person